One loss for me. Match time, 8 seconds. I guess you can tell I wasn't paying much attention. The so-called gym teacher came up behind me before my second match while my opponent was staring at me across the mat, generating aggression. "I'm not going to pass you for the unit if you don't try," he said. Here are the stats for the second match of the period. 1 takedown of me. 1 pin of me. 2nd loss for me. Match time, 36 seconds, which is 4.5 times longer than the first match. The so-called gym teacher eyed me from the other side of the mat. I eyed him back. Then he leaned down and said something to my next opponent, who turned to look at me. The so-called gym teacher said something to him again, and then he walked away. It was sort of creepy. Like you were the snowy heron, and you could feel that something was wrong, but you weren't sure, because you hadn't seen the hunter with the gun coming across the horizontal yet. But I'm not lying. The stats for the third match were different. When the so-called gym teacher blew his stupid whistle, this other guy and I got into the circle, and I crouched down as if I cared at all. And as we started to circle each other, he said, "Reed wants me to call you a mama's baby." I almost lunged at his throat. "But I'm not," he said quickly. "I'm not." We circled some more. "He's a jerk," the guy said. "Let's get something going," hollered the so-called gym teacher. We circled some more. And when my back was to the so-called gym teacher, I said, "Keep circling." So we did. And someone on the edge of the mat started to laugh. And then someone else. And then we started to circle faster. And pretty soon the whole place was laughing except for the so-called gym teacher. And this kid and I were laughing so hard we could hardly keep circling, but we kept going until we were dizzy. And finally, the so-called gym teacher hollered at us to sit down, and we did, except we both kept swaying, we were so dizzy. The so-called gym teacher was about as angry as you can see a teacher get. And when he called the next two guys up for their match, he could hardly keep the roar out of his sergeant voice. But you know what the two guys did? That's right. They circled. And circled. And circled. I think you can imagine what the so-called gym teacher did. If it had been legal, I think he would have called in firing squads. But since it wasn't legal, he told us that he was going to give every boy in class a big fat zero for the day. And we could see how we all liked that. Yes siree, Buster. We all went in to get changed. We were still laughing. No one in the locker room looked when I took my shirt off. Maybe the snowy heron is going to come off pretty badly when the planes come together. Maybe. But he's still proud and beautiful. His head is high. And he's got this sharp beak that's facing out to the world. He's okay for now. On the first Saturday of December, the month that Lucas was coming home, I waited for Lil outside the library after the deliveries. It was cold, and I'm not lying. The sky was iron. And Mrs. Windermere's coffee had worn off way before I got back into town, even before I passed the open meadow. A few snowflakes blew past in a hurry, which is how most people went by, too, all huddled together and their heads down and their arms close in. So you can see it was kind of noble for me to wait outside for her. But I hadn't really talked to her since Thanksgiving. And I guess I wanted to make sure that she still wasn't thinking of my stupid "shows how much you know," like I was still thinking of Principal Petey's stupid what he said. She came up the street with a load of books and stomped up the 6 steps to where I was waiting. And I said, "Hey," and she said, "Hey." But she said it in a way that meant she wasn't really saying, "Hey." She was really saying, "You are such a jerk, and I wish you would drop into some crack." So I knew she hadn't forgotten. "Are you coming into the library?" I said. And she looked at me like she was generating aggression, and she said, "Not now." "I wish you would," I said. "It's not much fun just drawing with Mr. Powell." "Oh," she said. "I didn't realize." "Well, I don't know very much about it, do I?" "If we stop in at your dad's deli, we could get 2 Cokes," I said. "Do you have any money?" she said. "No." "Then what you're really saying is that if we stopped in my dad's deli, I could get you a Coke, right?" I shrugged and smiled. Lil Spicer shook her head, and then she laughed. And I'm not lying. She smiled, too. "You know," she said, "you should smile more often." She handed me her books and took my arm. "Let's go," she said. That afternoon, after our Cokes, I drew that snowy heron like I was John James Audubon himself. Except my heron. He was strutting out into the world like that hunter would never, never come. Finally, 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 in the middle of December, we drove down to New York City in my father's new pickup, my father, my mother, and me. We left my brother home. First, because we wouldn't have room for him in the pickup once Lucas got there, and second, because my father wanted him to move the furniture around in our bedroom upstairs so that we could fit another bed in. This wasn't going to be easy, which my brother had pointed out, and which my father had answered with, "You know." I sat between them. My father was glaring at the cars on the expressway as if he were daring them to try, even try dinging up his new pickup. I wasn't sure why he was so all-fired worried about it. It was already pretty dinged up. You don't get a whole lot for $100 down payment, I guess. But whenever someone closed in on him, he rolled his window down and let them know, even though they had their windows rolled up because it was about 0 degrees outside. Of course, when my father opened his window, it made it about 0 degrees inside, too. And it didn't get warm again, because the heater didn't work in his new pickup. I guess he forgot when he bought it that we weren't living in, say, Miami. My mother was wearing her best blue coat. She looked out the window, too, most of the time. It was like she was trying to peer across the miles, right into the city, to find Lucas. Every time a bus passed us, she looked into all the windows. Who knew? He might be there. Me? I was watching for Joe Pepitone whenever a Ford Mustang drove by, because Joe Pepitone is the kind of guy who would drive a Ford Mustang. We got lost 3 times in New York City because, my father said, no one knew what they were doing when they laid out all the streets. Nothing made sense. And if you were there, you wouldn't either have pointed out that it made perfect sense, since the whole city is on a grid. You know you wouldn't. When we finally found the Port Authority bus station, we drove around it 8 times because he wasn't going to park in one of those garages where they take your money and then go joyriding in your truck. Not him. He was going to find a spot on the street, which we finally did about a half mile away. Which took a whole lot longer to drive than you might think, because we had to creak through a Stop the War protest that was spilling into all the side streets. By the time my father edged the pickup into a spot, my mother was near frantic. When he finally switched off the ignition, she got out, and I got out, and my mother started to walk toward the Port Authority. Just hold on, my father called. If we don't hurry, she said, we won't be there when his bus pulls in. So what? He said. He's been gone a... My mother didn't wait for him to finish. She turned away and began walking. I could have cheered. We were there on the bottom level of the Port Authority when Lucas's bus pulled in. My father, a couple of minutes after. I wish I could tell you what it was like, watching my mother smile while the bus parked. I wish I could tell you. But maybe you know, and I don't have to. There was the smell of diesel, and the screech of air brakes, and the big engine of the bus echoing off the cement walls and ceiling. There was the crowd of people all looking for someone they cared about who was on the bus and coming home for Christmas. There was the driver switching off the engine, taking off his hat and stretching, pushing back his hair. He reached forward and pulled a lever, and the doors opened and he got out and stretched again, then walked over to the luggage bins and bent to open them. And there were the passengers starting to get out, and they weren't Lucas, and they walked slow and unsteady, like they'd been crinkled up for a while in a seat too small. And one by one, they turned to the crowd and waved at someone. And that someone would run up, and they'd hug and kiss, and then go find their luggage. That's how it was. One by one, everyone coming off the bus, holding the rail as they stepped out, until everyone was off the bus, and the bus driver was standing by the empty luggage bins and closing them up, and then he looked over at us. "You folks waiting for a kid in the wheelchair?" he said. "No," said my father. But my mother gasped, and then she was running. She flew past the bus driver and up the stairs of the bus. We could hear her steps as she ran to the back. I came up behind her, and this is what I saw. My mother was kneeling down in front of my brother Lucas. One of the overhead lights was shining brightly on her hair, turning it all gold. She held Lucas's face in both her hands. Her blue coat was spread out, and it covered them both like wide wings, covered even the chair my brother was sitting in. She was kissing him, but I couldn't see his face until she reached to hold him close to her, and she put her head beside his. Then I could see him. I could see the wide gauze bandage across his eyes. And, oh God, it wasn't until she stood and turned to me that I could see why Lucas was in the chair. Both his legs were missing, above the knees. My mother looked at me. That smile. Next to them stood a smart soldier, his uniform perfect, his hat off and under his arm, looking away like he wasn't supposed to be seeing this. I walked down the aisle, touching each of the seats as I passed them. My mother watched each step I took. When I was in front of the wheelchair, she put her hand on the back of my brother's head, and he leaned into her. "Lucas," I said. He tilted his face up to me. "Hi, Doug," he said. He reached out and I took his hand. It was trembling a little. "I got dinged up," he said. "A little bit," I said. He smiled. I never saw it before, but he smiles like my mother. The soldier and I got Lucas down from the bus. It wasn't easy, and I think we hurt Lucas twice trying to get him down the bus steps, and again when we crowded him into the elevator, and again when we crowded him out of the elevator. But he never said a thing. And when we finally got him on the ground floor, He reached out, and the soldier shook his hand, and Lucas said, "Thank you, sir." And the soldier said, "It was an honor." And he saluted Lucas, who couldn't see him, but Lucas saluted back as if he somehow knew. Then my mother took his hand, and I got behind the chair and pushed him through the Port Authority and out onto the street. "Where are we?" he said. "New York City," I said. He lifted his face up to the air. The bright, cold sunshine shone down on him, but he couldn't see it. He was smelling instead. And then he turned his head, because he was hearing what suddenly we were all hearing. The Stop the War protest was marching toward us. People holding up signs with letters that dripped like blood, screaming into bullhorns, chanting, and sort of looking like the hunter coming across on the horizontal to the meeting of the diagonals, which is where we were standing. When the marchers in the front saw us, they tried to hold back, but the power of the marchers behind heaved them forward. And so instead, they turned sideways and skirted around us until we were in a pocket with the crowd touching us everywhere. And you know what they said when they saw my brother in his uniform, sitting in a wheelchair with bandages around his eyes, his legs gone? You know what they said? They said he got what he deserved. They said they were glad his eyes were gone. They said they were glad his legs were gone. They said he got done to him what he did to Vietnamese babies, and how did he like it? They said that's what happens when you let yourself get used by fascist pigs. My mother tried to get in front of Lucas, but the crowd was so thick and so close that she couldn't work herself around the wheelchair. She looked back at my father, and he pushed himself past her and stood in front of Lucas, who sat there the whole time, facing straight out, even when someone spit on him. He didn't say anything. He just took it, like there was nothing else he could do. You know what that feels like? It feels like having Principal Petey tell you that not a single teacher in the whole school gives a rip about you. Not a rip. Because they all gave up on you a long time ago, like on the day you started. That's what it feels like. It probably went on like that for only a few minutes, but it felt a lot longer. And when the crowd finally thinned out and the last protester had hated him, we got back to the pickup, and my father started it up, while my mother and I helped Lucas out of the wheelchair and into the cab. And my father swore when he had to get out after my mother came around the front to get in through the driver's side. I got in the back and pulled the wheelchair into the pickup. It was heavier than I thought it would be, and I had to be careful because my father sure hoped I wasn't dinging up his pickup while I was getting that thing in. I put the wheelchair down on its side and leaned against it so it wouldn't roll around as we headed out of Manhattan and back up toward Marysville to a house my brother had never seen, and maybe wouldn't see now. Not that he was missing much. It was a long drive, and I think you can imagine how cold it was for one of us especially. But I kept wondering, every time we hit a bump and the stupid shocks in the pickup didn't do a thing, how much it was hurting Lucas. Probably a lot. When we pulled into the driveway, my father got out and went into the dump. I lowered the wheelchair over the side and jumped out and opened the door. Lucas's face was pretty grim. I'm not lying. My mother had been crying, so her face was pretty grim, too. I wasn't sure how we were going to get Lucas out of the pickup, especially without hurting him more. I guess he wondered about that, too, because he said, "Doug, if you wheel the thing below me, maybe I could sort of fall into it." It took me a couple of seconds to see that he was kidding, even though there's nothing funny about missing your legs, you know. Then the front door of the dump opened, and I thought it was probably my father coming back to help out. It wasn't. It was my brother. He looked at me, then he looked inside the truck at my mother and Lucas. "Lucas," he said. "Hey," said Lucas. My brother looked at me again, and then he reached into the pickup. "Tell me if this hurts," he said. And he reached around Lucas, and Lucas reached an arm around my brother's neck, and he lifted him out, just like that, and set him down in the wheelchair. "Thanks, little brother," said Lucas. And my brother Christopher, he said, "Anytime, Lucas, whenever you want." So we wheeled Lucas into the dump, and my father said, "How did we think we were going to get him up to our room in a wheelchair?" And Christopher said, "We got it figured out." And Lucas gave that smile. I really did try to care during the volleyball unit in PE that week, but you have to admit, volleyball is not that great a sport. You don't hear Jim McKay announcing the thrill of victory that comes from winning a volleyball game. I mean, slapping a ball around and getting it over a net? What's the point to that? There's a reason that no one carries stats about volleyball around in his head. But I really did try to care. And I even tried to care about the wrestling unit. Not enough to try to win, but enough to keep things going for a minute or two without a whole lot of circling, which the so-called gym teacher announced would get the two circlers two more big fat zeros. And no, I didn't say a thing about my surprise at him being able to understand the mathematical concept of zero. Remember? I got it. And I didn't even complain about having to be in the wrestling unit at all, which I had reason to, since you may have noticed that James Russell and Otis Bottom weren't there with me, even though they had missed most of the wrestling unit, too. But so what? So what? If the so-called gym teacher wants to be the jerk of the world, so what? If he wants to boom around in his sergeant voice, so what? But maybe you can understand a little when I tell you that when the so-called gym teacher hollered at me during volleyball that I should go after those balls and not act like a mama's baby, you can understand why I got the volleyball and was about to throw it as hard as I could into his sneering face. But I held back, and I'm not lying, it wasn't easy, and I told him to shut up, just shut up. And he sneered some more and said I would never throw the volleyball because I knew what would happen to me, and my mother would be all upset, wouldn't she? I almost threw it. I almost did. But I didn't. I smiled. The way Lil Spicer likes. Then I took off my shirt and threw it onto the bleachers. I went back and served the stupid ball over the stupid net. Overhand. Stats for that game? I don't remember. My platoon lost. It's volleyball. Who cares? It wasn't exactly the agony of defeat. It was something a whole lot better. But I'm not lying. All that week, the so-called gym teacher did not let up. On Tuesday, he made three guys in the wrestling unit run the bleachers all period because they weren't trying hard enough. Guess who was one of the three guys? Then later, during volleyball, he made two guys clean off the scuff marks from the gym floors with old tennis balls. Guess who is one of the two guys? On Wednesday, during the wrestling unit, he made two guys run the bleachers all period because they weren't trying hard enough. Guess who was one of the two? And in volleyball, I had to finish all the scuff marks I'd missed on my side of the floor. On Thursday, he had four guys finally wash the sweaty wrestling mats down. Guess who was one of the four? In volleyball, he told four guys that they were going to stand in the middle of the court and try to retrieve balls that were spiked down to them. We were supposed to dive. You know what that feels like? Diving onto a gym floor for 43 minutes? Then he told us that the next day would be the stunning climax of the wrestling and volleyball units. Terrific. So on Friday, the last day before Christmas vacation, the so-called gym teacher said he had picked random wrestling partners by choosing our names from slips of paper he'd cut up and put into a hat. He held up his clipboard. He said he'd call out the names two by two, starting with the first pair to wrestle. Guess who was in the first pair? My partner turned out to be Alfred Hartnett. I'll let you guess again. Do you think Alfred Hartnett weighed about the same as me? Or about 16 times more? The so-called gym teacher smiled when he called my name and then Alfred Hartnett's. He put the clipboard down on the bleacher and leaned back. "Let's get it going," he said. I'm not lying. Even if I had been trying, it wouldn't have made any difference. Alfred Hartnett laid an arm across me, and I went down. It was, for the record, his left arm, not his strong side. He was a good guy. The so-called gym teacher thought it was hilarious. After the period, he went back to his office and left two guys, me and Alfred Hartnett, hilarious, to roll up the mats for Christmas vacation. They weren't so bad, because, as you might remember, they'd gotten cleaned off earlier that week. When we finished, we walked back toward the locker room, and I saw that the so-called gym teacher had left his clipboard and the slips of paper on the bleacher. I looked at the clipboard. Wouldn't you have wanted to know? Not a single name on it. The so-called gym teacher had set it all up. There wasn't anything random at all, the jerk. I flipped over the page. Blank. "Hey, Alfred," I said. I flipped over another page. It wasn't blank. It was a drawing. A drawing of James Russell going for a layup. Behind him, you could make out every kid in our platoon. I'm not lying. The so-called gym teacher knew something about composition on several planes at once. I flipped over another page. Otis Bottom, hanging about halfway up the climbing rope, looking like there was no way in creation he was going to get up any higher. Another page. Me, running. Another page. Our whole platoon, smacking volleyballs around. Another page. Our whole platoon really playing volleyball this time. Me serving. No shirt. And no tattoo. I looked at that a while. Then I skipped some pages and turned to the back of the pad. And stopped. A drawing of a low road between high grasses. Bodies. Lots of bodies. All jumbled and thrown on top of one another. Another page. A Vietnamese man, old and worn. Dead. His eyes open, and his body lying crooked on the ground. Behind him, a young girl, naked, reaching for his hand. But she never made it. Another page. A boy, younger than me. A straw hat broken underneath him. His face, what was left of it, with a terrified eye. Burning huts behind him. Bodies all along the road to the huts. The words, me lie, at the bottom. And I was there. Swiatek, what do you think you're doing? It was a so-called gym teacher. He came across the gym like a thunderhead bearing down across the valley and grabbed the clipboard out of my hands. What are you doing, looking at my personal things? Coach, I said, you get out of here! Screaming, shrieking sergeant voice. Get out of here! Never touch my things again! Did you hear me? You get out! I went into the locker room to change. Later that day, Miss Cowper, and I didn't ask for this, it just seemed to happen. Miss Cowper wrote me an excuse from P.E. so that I could help her refresh her county literacy unit. I never did find out what the stunning climax of the volleyball unit was. Lucas didn't talk much, and when he did talk, it was never around my father. It was mostly around my mother. You could hear them late at night, when everything was quiet and dark. There would be these low voices, then quiet, then the low voices again, sometimes crying. Every night, when they were alone, my mother would change the gauze bandage around Lucas's eyes. Then her voice would call quietly up the stairs, and Christopher would go down to bring Lucas up to our bedroom. He wouldn't talk about what happened, how he lost his legs and maybe his eyes. Sometimes you'd come into the kitchen, and he would be sitting by the kitchen table where the sunlight was coming in. And he'd have his face raised to it, like he could see its warmth. Sometimes you saw him try to lift his body up and down in the chair, like he was lifting a weight, which he pretty much was. Sometimes he would get letters from people in his unit, or from the doctors and nurses who had worked on him after he was wounded. I told him I would read them for him. He never wanted me to. He told me to throw them all away, which I didn't. His stumps hurt him. And sometimes he would reach down to where his legs used to be. He wanted to scratch them, but there was no place to scratch. He'd still try, and then he'd give up and put his hands over his face, and you could tell he was doing everything he could not to let himself think that everything was ruined forever. We were supposed to go down with Lucas to a doctor in New York City every 2 weeks for who knows how long. But when my father said he couldn't be traipsing all over the state every 2 weeks, we found a doctor in Kingston who would see him. And when my father put up an all-fired fuss at the first visit about how much it cost, the doctor said he had a son in Vietnam too, right now, a medic. So he'd take Lucas on for as long as his son was over there. And my father said he wasn't asking for any freaking charity, and the doctor stopped talking to him and told Lucas he'd see him in 2 weeks, and he gave him some exercises to work on. Lucas didn't do them. 2 weeks later, just before school was about to start after Christmas vacation, we went up to Kingston again, and the doctor had an eye doctor waiting, too. My father said he wasn't going to be gypped, and he hadn't brought any money, so if he thought that... The eye doctor turned his back on him and unwrapped the gauze from Lucas's face. Then he turned to my father. Anything else? He said. It was the first time my father had seen Lucas without the bandage. It was the first time I had, too. burns all across his face. Whatever skin was left was shiny and stretched. His eyebrows and eyelashes were gone, it looked like for good. And everything was seeping. Everything looked wet and raw. He'd lost the sky. Christmas, as you can guess, wasn't exactly ho-ho-ho around our house. On Christmas Eve, my father went out somewhere with Ernie Echo, and Lucas didn't want to go to midnight mass, and so Christopher stayed with him, and my mother and I went. We didn't have a tree, and if it hadn't been for the ham that Mr. Ballard sent home to all his employees, I think we would have been celebrating with thawed hamburgers. Presents? Forget it. So I went to St. Ignatius, and it was cold and damp like it usually was, outside and inside, except inside there were more candles lit than you'd think could fit inside a single church. Up front there were two balsam trees, and their scent mixed with the waxy smell of the candles. And there was a cradle beside the altar, a blue cloth draped over it. And there was a choir of perfect boys in perfect white robes, with perfect combed hair, singing their perfect notes like everything was perfect. And I thought of Lucas back home in his wheelchair. And so I couldn't understand it when my mother turned to me during Hark the Herald Angels Sing and said, loud enough to hear over the organ and the perfect choir, "What a wonderful Christmas this is." I shivered. Even with all those candles, it was still cold. That wasn't the only time I shivered. I shivered late at night after Christopher carried Lucas up to bed and we had gotten him in and covered. Then we would lie awake and listen to his dreams. And I would see the young boy with the broken straw hat, the burning huts, the girl's hand, me lie. I was there. Then Lucas would try to turn over, and there would be a low moan, and Christopher would get up. And I knew that Lucas was awake in the dark that he carried around with him all the time. "What can I do?" Christopher would say. "You weren't there. You can't do anything." None of us knew how to make it light. At the beginning of the first physical science class of the new year, Mr. Ferris set Clarence on the front lab table and started him rocking. "Do you know, Otis Bottom," he asked, "what historic event in the sciences will occur during this new year of 1969? Otis Bottom looked like he didn't really want to be back from Christmas break yet. He could have guessed all day and not gotten close. "Doug Swiatek?" Mr. Ferris asked.
"The moonshot," whispered Lil.
"The moonshot," I said. "Thank you, Lil Spicer. Yes, the moonshot. Apollo 8 has circumnavigated the moon and descended to 69.8 miles over the lunar surface. Think of that. From the very beginning of human consciousness, we have looked at the moon and wondered what it would be like to walk on it. In 1969, what man has wondered about for thousands and thousands of years, you may be able to see on your television screens. It is our first step out into the solar system. It is our first step out into the galaxy." Clarence was really rocking. I'm not lying.
"So what are they going to find there?"
Otis Bottom was trying to recover.
"Ah, Otis Bottom,
That is the question. What are they going to find there? Who knows? Maybe everything will be exactly as they expect. Maybe everything will be a surprise. But one day soon, man will walk across the soil of the lunar landscape, and that will be a sign of our progress. In a time when it doesn't seem as if we're making much progress anywhere else, this, ladies and gentlemen, is a sign of tremendous possibility. And that, Otis Bottom, is perhaps the best answer to your question. They will find possibility there. I thought of Lucas in his darkness. Wouldn't he like to see it? I went through the rest of that day in a kind of daze. I mean, the moon. Possibility. Geez, the moon. In January, all of Coach Reed's classes were starting a new unit in PE, physical fitness and endurance. We were going to have a whole lot of tests to see how many sit-ups we could do in 4 minutes, and how many push-ups and squat thrusts and leg lifts and chin-ups, along with timed 100-yard dashes and mile runs. We were supposed to compare ourselves to the President's Council on Physical Fitness goals that all American boys should be trying to reach so we wouldn't die of heart attacks someday. So that period, we spent practicing the correct way to do push-ups and sit-ups, and after that we took turns holding each other's ankles and counting sit-ups, or holding fists beneath each other so that you could tell how far down your chest had to go for a good push-up, and we got timed for a trial run. It was about as exciting as it sounds. You know how the snowy heron has its beak pointed out to the world? How it doesn't care that the hunter is coming up the path? How he looks at the hunter and says, "So what?" How he sees possibility? After class, when everyone was headed into the locker room, I stopped at Coach Reed's office. He was sitting behind his desk, which was covered with presidential fitness charts with lots of little spaces that needed filling in. "Hello," I said. He looked up from his clipboard, then turned it over. "What do you want?" he said. "I saw some of your drawings." "You're good," I said. He looked at the face-down clipboard. Then he looked at me with suspicious eyes. "So?" "You drew the war," I said. Coach Reed not saying anything. His hand pressing down on the clipboard, pressing it into the desk. "My brother was there too," I said. "He's back." A long minute passing. "No, he's not," said Coach Reed finally, not in his sergeant voice. "No one ever comes back from Vietnam. Not really." He picked up the clipboard and held it against his chest. "He's not reading the letters he gets." Coach Reed nodded. "He needs someone who knows what it was like." Coach Reed looked at me. I looked at the clipboard. "Maybe you do too," I said. "Get out, Swiatek," he said. "I'm busy." Sergeant voice back. "I could help," I said. He laughed. Not a happy laugh. "Help," he said. "I could take care of those charts. I could write down everyone's names and keep track of where they start, what kind of progress they make, where they finish. Stats like that." Coach Reed got up and sat on the edge of his desk.
"Why so helpful?" he said.
"Do you want me to do it or not?"
"Not,"
he said. I shrugged.
"Okay."
I turned to go.
"Wait a minute," he said.
He fingered the clipboard.
"I'll think about it. Go get changed. I'll let you know when you come back."
I nodded.
"Okay."
When I came back, his office door was closed. But on the door, there was a note.
"Swiatek," it said.
"Start with the second period stats." I stayed after school to start. "You know, Mr. Powell," I said the next Saturday, "I don't think Audubon had this right. I mean, about the hunter."
"Do you think he's in the wrong place in the picture?"
"No. He shouldn't be in the picture at all."
"What would you have put there instead?"
"Another heron." "He's just seen her. And he's going to fly over to say hi."
"It would be a different story," said Mr. Powell. "What do you think, Lil?"
She came over and looked at the picture. Then she took my hand. "You know what that feels like? Like what the astronauts will feel when they step onto the moon for the very first time. Like what might happen if Coach Reed rang the doorbell at the dump some afternoon and sat down next to Lucas. Like knowing that Principal Petey is wrong about what he said. Like laying a missing bird picture back where it's supposed to be. Like someone seeing what a chump you are and getting you a cold Coke anyway. Like possibility." Chapter 7. The Forked-Tailed Petrel. Plate 260. "Do you know how often it snows in stupid Marysville during a winter? Once a week. Maybe twice. And do you know on what day of the week it always snows? Saturday. Every Saturday for most of January and on into February. Every Saturday. You remember what I do on Saturday mornings? And do you think deliveries stop just because it's snowing and blowing and blizzarding and the snow isn't turning to slush like it would on Long Island and it's getting deeper and deeper and the cold is so bad that Joe Pepitone's jacket doesn't help much at all? And my fingers are starting to stick to the handle of the wagon, so I have to pull Joe Pepitone's sleeves down over my hands, but I don't have anything for my ears, which were about to snap off until Mr. Leffler gave me this gray wool cap that Lil says looks great on me, but I think makes me look like a chump, but I wear it anyway because I really don't want my ears to snap off. And besides, did I tell you that Lil says it looks great on me?" Every Saturday it was the same. I'd wake up, and it would still be dark because the clouds were thick and it was already snowing hard, and it had been snowing hard for most of the night so the ground was covered, and the sidewalks and the streets too. While Lucas and Christopher slept, I'd put on about everything I had beneath Joe Pepitone's jacket, and then I'd put on the gray wool cap that Lil says looks great on me, and I'd lace up my sneakers and head out into the snow, and my feet would be cold and wet in three steps. Mr. Spicer always had a cup of hot chocolate for me to start off each of the runs, and I'd drink it and go out with the first load. In the beginning of January, I did this with the wagons. But pretty soon Mr. Spicer figured that I'd do a whole lot better with this old toboggan he had. So that's what I'd use. And it went a whole lot quicker. I'm not lying. But you can't believe how cold the wind can blow in stupid Marysville. Mrs. Mason always had a cup of warm milk waiting for me, Because I'd told her like a chump that Mr. Spicer always started me off with hot chocolate, and she wanted to be sure to give me something different, she said. So it was hot milk. I got used to it. Mr. Leffler always had a cup of hot tea waiting for me. I got used to that, too. Mrs. Daugherty always had a bowl of cream of wheat waiting for me. I did not get used to that. Phronsie whispered that it was good if you put a whole lot of brown sugar on it. It wasn't. Mrs. Windermere always had a cup of hot coffee waiting for me. Black, which, she said, was the only way to drink it if you wanted to be awake to serve the god of creativity. Which she needed to do a whole lot since she was working on a stage adaptation of... Guess. Yep. Jane Eyre. I'm not lying. When I told her that the only people who read Jane Eyre were people who had to because their English teachers made them read it, and no one in their right mind was going to pay good money to sit in front of a stage and have all this acted out, she sipped her coffee and said, "Skinny delivery boy, I'm not even finished with it and people are already lining up to buy tickets." Can you imagine anyone buying tickets to Jane Eyre? Can you imagine Joe Pepitone buying tickets to Jane Eyre? Me neither. I spent that winter with my head down against the wind, pulling the stupid toboggan, my hands up Joe Pepitone's sleeves, and always having to go to the bathroom because of the cold and the warm hot chocolate, milk, tea, coffee. But afterward, when I got back from Mrs. Windermere's, Lil would be waiting at the deli, and Mr. Spicer would heat up some chicken noodle soup for us, his own recipe, with lots of chicken and onion, and I'd take off my sopping sneakers and lay them beside the radiator, and take off my sopping socks and lay them on the radiator, and I'd stretch my sopping feet as close as I could get them to the radiator, and I'd eat the chicken noodle soup until I was warm again. And then we'd go to the library, where Mr. Powell was waiting for us, and where we had started to work on gesture. Which, by the way, the snowy heron would have been good for, but it was gone now, too, because of the snow. I'm not lying. Stupid Marysville had so much snow that winter that the town ran out of money to pay for the plowing and the salting and the sanding. So the town council went over to the library, like it was a bank or something, and took a razor blade with them, and the next time Mr. Powell came in, the snowy heron was cut out, just like that, and sold off somewhere to pay for more plowing and salting and sanding. If you're trying to get Audubon's pages back, and stupid Marysville is selling them off faster than you can find them, it gets sort of discouraging. So here are the stats for Volume 3 of John James Audubon's Birds of America, owned by the Marysville Free Public Library of Stupid Marysville, New York. Total number of plates, 100. The Arctic Tern, missing, sold to an anonymous collector from overseas. The Red-Throated Diver, in Mrs. Windermere's house. The Large-Billed Puffin, missing. Mr. Powell won't tell me where. The Brown Pelican, in Principal Petey's office. The Yellow Shank, returned by Mr. Ballard, who is a good guy. The Snowy Heron, missing. Mr. Powell won't tell me where. Total removed from Birds of America, 6. Total returned to Birds of America, 1. Total to be returned to Birds of America, 5. Terrific. When you're considering gesture, said Mr. Powell, you're not imagining the birds as if they're posing for you. You're imagining them moving across the page instead of staying put. Your pencil is going to show them not only at the moment of the picture, but the moment before and the moment that is going to come after. I looked at Mr. Powell. He started to laugh. Try this. You're not going to draw a picture of the bird. You're going to draw a picture of the bird's flight line.
How do I do that?
Don't think of the bird as a flat image. Think of it the whole way around, even the parts that you don't see. Then think of how all the different pieces of the bird are working with or against each other. Think how the body of the bird wants to fall. And the wings want to keep it up.
Exactly.
All movement relies on that kind of tension. You show the movement by suggesting the tension.
And how do I do that?
That was when we looked at the forked-tailed petrels. Things at Washington Irving Junior High School were going mostly okay. My geography, the story of the world, was as clean as you could expect after half a year. Mr. Barber still checked it out, leaning down over me when I was working on the chapter review map about India. I could smell his coffee, and even though it didn't smell as good as Mrs. Windermere's, which she percolated before I came, it still smelled pretty good. In world history, Mr. McElroy had found 8 film strips about the history of the Philippines. The record pinged away at us just about every class. Terrific. In English, Miss Cowper was throwing us into the introduction to poetry unit like it was as all-fired important as the moonshot. You know, there are good reasons to learn how to read. Poetry isn't one of them. I mean, so what if 2 roads go 2 ways in a wood? So what? Who cares if it made all that big a difference? What difference? And why should I have to guess what the difference is? Isn't that what he's supposed to say? Why can't poets just say what they want to say and then shut up? In math, Mrs. Verne selected a group of students who had shown excellence and promise to work together on advanced algebra. Guess who was in it? Lil, too. You know how that feels? In Mr. Ferris's physical science class, we were distilling aspirins, very large aspirins, which by the time the last bell rang, Mr. Ferris said he needed. Clarence was rocking his little hooves off these days because the moonshot was still on go-ahead, and it looked like it wouldn't be long before there were human footprints on the lunar surface, as Mr. Ferris kept reminding us. When we asked him if making aspirin was as important as men going to the moon, he rubbed his head and looked kind of painfully at us and said, "Believe me, aspirin is pretty darn important." And in case you're wondering how things have been going with Coach Reed, January and February were mostly okay, too. I filled in all the presidential physical fitness charts for him in both periods. He'd call out the numbers, and I'd write them down where they were supposed to be. When he had to do the written comments at the end of the charts, he told me what to write, and I did it. I told him maybe my spelling wasn't going to be all that terrific, but he said he didn't care. A few days into this, he brought me a new gym shirt so that I didn't have to wear my undershirt anymore. He handed it to me one morning after we finished a periods chart. "Thanks," I said. "My brother isn't talking much these days, and he dreams a lot."
"Go shower," he said. "You'll be late for your next class."
There are 2 forked-tailed petrels. They're in the middle of a green, stormy sea, and the waves are about as high as they're flying. They're heading closer, and their sharp beaks are open, because they're calling to each other kind of desperately. "Look at the way the wind is blowing the waves," said Mr. Powell. "Anything odd about it?" I shook my head. "Look again," he said. "Pay attention to the composition." He was right. 2 winds were blowing the waves in 2 directions, completely apart. So how are the birds' bodies responding to those winds? The two winds were pushing them in different directions, but the petrels were using them.